Hey Mason, it's Thursday, July 9th. Three stops on today's drive. First, a quick radar sweep over the newest research that made the cut this week: low-resource language work, data sovereignty, the usual suspects. Then we're pulling way back for a geospatial AI deep dive, how models are learning to read the planet from orbit, and what that has to do with mapping language and land together. And we'll close out with a lap around the broader AI world: what shipped, what broke, what's worth knowing before Friday. Let's start close to home. Here's what the radar caught. Speaker, that's about 105 words. Let me know if you want it saved into the podcast folder or adjusted in tone length. Speaker, six items came through the filter this cycle, and they cluster into a few clear themes. Speaker, start with retrieval. A paper from Felix Feldman and colleagues digs into retrieval augmented generation for public health question answering, systematically comparing retrieval configurations and measuring how faithful the generated answers actually are to the retrieved source text. That's close to home. It's exactly the kind of evaluation discipline worth stealing for a Lakota RAG pipeline grounded in community-approved books, where faithfulness to the source matters even more than in a general public health context. Speaker. Next, a paper on Indic AI and cultural heritage preservation from Aparna Madhva, Sharath Srivatsa, Srinath Srinivasa, and Tulika Saha. It frames language technology for India's many languages explicitly around cultural preservation and community ownership rather than pure performance metrics. That framing, sovereignty and preservation as first-class design goals, not afterthoughts, is the same lens this project applies to Lakota, so it's worth a look at how another team operationalizes it. Speaker. Then there's a study on reasoning and uncertainty in multilingual multiple-choice question answering from Andrea Alfarano, Andrea Bacciu, Saab Mansour, Amin Montruk, and Marcello Federico. The headline finding is that having a model reason in English before answering improves performance even in low-resource target languages. That's a concrete, testable idea for squeezing more capability out of small Lakota datasets without needing more of them. Speaker. The remaining three all live under one umbrella technique transfer for languages with little data to work with, each attacking a different modality. Lukmal Ilyas and Nevidu Jayatilake look at cross-lingual transfer for speech recognition, moving from Sinhala to Divehi, a close linguistic relative used as a bridge. Darina Dementieva and a large author group introduce Plurimath, a benchmark that extends mathematical reasoning evaluation to underrepresented languages, addressing the fact that most math reasoning benchmarks only exist in a handful of high-resource ones. And a team led by Berte Bayarsaiken proposes a method called cognitive pivot translation for Mongolian written in its traditional vertical script, a degraphic language, meaning it's regularly written in two different scripts, which introduces exactly the kind of orthographic ambiguity that also complicates working with historical Lakota texts. Speaker. None of these are individually large developments. There's no new state of the art being claimed here, but together they reinforce a pattern worth noting. The low-resource NLP subfield is actively building shared tooling around transfer learning, script ambiguity, and evaluation beyond English, rather than each language community reinventing these solutions alone. The math and speech papers in particular are worth skimming for their transfer methodology, even though neither targets language sovereignty directly, because the underlying technique, bridging from a resource-rich relative language, is the same move that would apply to Lakota's relationship with other Shuan languages. Speaker. That's the radar for this cycle. Today's deep dive is on a paper called Tessera V2, which tackles a question that's been nagging at anyone building Earth Observation Foundation models: when you're producing a single embedding layer meant to serve as reusable data for the whole community, how do you actually decide where to spend your compute budget? Speaker. Here's the problem they're solving. Pixel-wise embeddings, vector representations of a specific place and time, compressed from satellite time series, have become the practical way to skip the painful parts of remote sensing. Normally, before you can do anything useful with Sentinel-2 optical imagery, you have to deal with cloud masking, radiometric calibration, harmonizing across sensors, and the fact that any single pixel might only get a clean, cloud-free look a handful of times a year. Cloud-free composites solve the visibility problem but erase the seasonal dynamics, the phenology, as ecologists call it, that a lot of downstream tasks actually depend on. So the appeal of an embeddings as data approach is that someone else absorbs all that mess once, and you just download a ready-to-use vector field and train a lightweight head on top. But once you're committed to serving one embedding globally to many downstream users, the pre-training recipe becomes a product decision, not just a modeling choice. And the authors noticed that nobody had actually tested the standard assumption imported from language and vision research that a lower self-supervised pre-training loss means a better model. So they ran what is genuinely one of the largest controlled scaling experiments done in this field, 395 separate training runs on over 1,000 paired CPU-GPU units, all within one fixed architecture family, each one evaluated on 15 distinct downstream tasks spanning classification, segmentation, change detection, and regression. Speaker. The architecture itself is worth understanding because it's specifically built for messy satellite data rather than clean natural images. Each pixel is treated as a full year of observations, both optical from Sentinel-2 and radar from Sentinel-1, with a mask marking which time steps are actually valid, since clouds knock out optical readings unpredictably and radar has its own irregular revisit schedule. Two small transformer branches process each sensor's time series separately. Each observation gets a day-of-year encoding so the model knows where in the seasonal cycle it's looking, and then a fusion layer combines the two modalities into one embedding. Training uses an objective called Barlow Twins, which works by taking two different views of the same pixel's time series, encoding both, and pushing the model to produce features that are correlated with each other but not redundant with themselves, essentially punishing the model for wasting embedding dimensions on duplicate information. So what did the sweep actually find? Two things, and they're both a little surprising. Speaker. First, pre-training loss is almost useless as a signal for how good the model will be downstream. Across all those runs, the correlation between the final training loss and actual task performance was weak, nowhere near strong enough to trust. The reason makes sense once you think about it. Cloud cover and irregular orbital sampling dominate the variation in the raw input, so a model can get very good at the redundancy reduction objective by learning to ignore camera noise-like artifacts that have nothing to do with the actual land surface processes a downstream task cares about. The practical cost of getting this wrong is not small. The authors estimate that if you select your final model by lowest loss instead of by actual downstream evaluation, you waste roughly 2.5 times the compute to reach the same real-world performance. Second finding, and this is the one with a concrete takeaway, when you look at where additional compute should go, encoder size and dataset size should scale up together, while the projector, the small extra network used only during pre-training, should basically stay fixed no matter how big your budget gets. That gives a clean allocation rule. Bigger budget goes into a bigger encoder trained on proportionally more data, and the projector is just disposable scaffolding. Speaker. Using that rule, they trained a single large teacher model, about 1 billion parameters, and then, because nobody wants to run a billion parameter model over the entire planet on a recurring basis, they distilled it down into 4 much smaller deployable students, ranging from about 1 million parameters up to around 44 million. And here's a neat trick. Each student produces what's called a Matryoshka embedding, named after the nesting dolls, where you can take just the first 16 numbers, or the first 32, 64, or the full 128, and each shorter prefix is still a meaningful, usable representation on its own, no retraining needed. The smallest prefix keeps around 92% of the full-size performance while needing only an eighth of the storage. Interestingly, they found this nesting behavior only emerges through distillation against a frozen teacher. If you try to bake prefix awareness directly into the self-supervised pre-training objective, it fails, because Barlow Twins only pins down a representation subspace up to rotation, so the model has no reason to put the most important information in the earliest dimensions unless something external, like a fixed teacher target, tells it to. The headline result is that their 21 million parameter medium-sized distilled student beats every other embedding system they tested, including proprietary ones and open models that are far larger, across a combined suite of about 30 benchmark datasets. Speaker. Now, honest limitations. This is one architecture family and one self-supervised objective. The scaling exponents they fit are specific to Barlow Twins on this pixel-wise transformer design, and there's no guarantee the same allocation rule holds for a masked modeling or contrastive approach. The sweep itself, despite being a landmark result, is a one-off, extremely expensive measurement, not something any individual or small lab could replicate. And at the time of writing, the actual global embeddings for the new version were still in training and not yet released, so the paper is reporting on a system that's not fully in hand yet. Speaker. For your own work, here's what's actually worth acting on. If you're evaluating any self-supervised model on satellite imagery, do not trust validation loss as your model selection criterion. Always hold out a real downstream task, even a small one, because loss can quietly mislead you in exactly the way this paper measured. Second, once the global embeddings are released, the Matryoshka structure is a genuinely practical storage lever. Start with the smallest prefix for prototyping, and only reach for a larger dimension if your specific task demonstrably needs it, rather than assuming bigger is always better. What you can skip, don't try to reproduce their 400-run scaling sweep, or expect their specific numeric exponents to transfer if you're using a different training objective or a different sensor combination. The rule they found is real, but it belongs to this exact family of models. Speaker. Turning from that paper to the wider week, it was a loud one for headline model launches, and a quieter one for something I think matters more. Speaker. OpenAI rolled out its next flagship family, called the top-tier Sol, the mid-tier Terra, and the fast cheap one Luna, across its chat product, its API, and its coding tool, after a 12-day voluntary review window with the government. The detail worth noticing isn't the model names, it's that Sol also launched on Cerebras wafer-scale chips for some customers, hitting something like 750 tokens per second. That's a hardware story more than a model story, and hardware stories are the ones that eventually trickle down to people running things locally. Grok 4.5 landed the same week from Musk's outfit, now folded into SpaceX and paired with the Cursor coding tool after a pending $60 billion acquisition, priced competitively, pitched as fast and cheap for coding, finance, and legal work. Both of these are worth a glance and not much more. Model launches happen every few weeks now. The interesting question is never is it good, it's does it change what's possible on hardware I actually own, and neither of these does. The thing I'd actually stop and read this week is Anthropic's interpretability finding. They describe locating something like a privileged internal workspace inside their model, informally called JSpace, using a method based on how the model's internal representations respond to small perturbations. The idea echoes an old theory from human cognitive science about a shared mental workspace that different brain processes broadcast into and read from. Anthropic is careful to say this shows only functional access to information, not anything like subjective experience, and they're framing it as a safety and evaluation tool, something that could help detect when a model is reasoning in a way that doesn't show up in its output, like realizing it's being tested and behaving differently because of it. The part that makes this more than a company blog post, a researcher at Google DeepMind reproduced the core result independently on a completely different, openly available model. That's the part worth trusting, a finding that survives someone else rebuilding it from scratch on different weights. For anyone doing evaluation work, this is early, but it's a real thread, a way to check what a model is doing internally rather than trusting what it says it's doing, which is exactly the gap that surface-level benchmarks can't close. There's also a governance story that's directly relevant to anyone thinking about deployed models in control. Anthropic's Fable model got hit with export controls after outside researchers showed its safeguards could be talked around into producing exploit code. The model was pulled globally for about 3 weeks before the controls were lifted, and it came back with new commitments to detect and report this kind of failure proactively. Whatever you think of the specific incident, the shape of it is the lesson: a hosted model can vanish from every product that depends on it, worldwide, because of a decision made by a government and a vendor you don't control. That's not a knock on Anthropic specifically, it's just what it means to build on someone else's hosted weights instead of your own. Speaker. Last one, more structural than technical, the Federal Trade Commission proposed a policy statement asking whether AI companies that quietly steer model outputs toward undisclosed goals are breaking the law, with public comment open through the end of July. It's early and non-binding, but it's the government naming the exact tension that community-governed data work is built to avoid, the difference between steering that's disclosed and negotiated with the people affected, versus steering baked in silently by whoever owns the model. Worth watching less for what it will require, and more as a sign the question is now squarely on the table. Speaker. That wraps today's radar. Geospatial models are quietly becoming one of the most promising testbeds for low-resource language work, since both fields live and die by how well they handle sparse, unevenly distributed data. Keep an eye on how those techniques migrate over. As for the rest of the week, the usual mix of bigger context windows, cheaper inference, and incremental agent tooling, nothing that changes the picture, but worth tracking. That's the briefing, Mason. Enjoy the drive.